The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Chris O'Leary is the guest this week, and we discuss his book, Rebel Rebel, which is coming from Zero Books in just a few days, with the tagline, "Every single song, everything you want to know, everything you didn't know." The book catalogs all of Bowie's songs from 1964 through 1976. The cultural critic Mark Derry, author of All the Young Dudes, Why Glam Rock Matters, sent me a blurb for O'Leary, and I'll read it now. Marooned in 70s suburbia, I and countless weirdos like me awaited every new Bowie record as a deep space ping from a world where weird ruled. Proof that there really was life on Mars, if not in tract home sprawl. To date, what passes for thoughtful inquiry into the polymorphous, polyvalent phenomenon that is David Bowie has consisted almost entirely of potted biographies and coffee table photo albums. At last, the Homo Superior gets the exegesis he deserves. Rebel Rebel is the lipstick traces of Bowie's studies, and Chris O'Leary, its unchallenged dean. I should also point out to you that you can win a copy of O'Leary's book, a free copy, by entering the fictional Bowie Lyric Contest at davidbowienews.com, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's Wednesday, March 25th, 2015, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In this episode, you'll hear a clip from Chris Hadfield on the International Space Station. I think you know the one. A clip of a cover of Kim Wilde's The Kids in America, done by Nirvana. David Bowie with Bing Crosby from Bing Crosby's Merry Old Christmas. And an Andy Warhol-David Bowie interview juxtaposition. The music you're listening to right now is Bowie's Wasawa, played on a mini-Moog by the YouTube star Orchestron. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to O'Leary and I discuss Rebel Rebel. Chris O'Leary is a writer, editor, and journalist based in Western Massachusetts. He writes for Entertainment Weekly as well as for the Encyclopedia Britannica and on his blog, Pushing Ahead the Dame. He writes about David Bowie one song at a time over there, and his book, Rebel Rebel, is out from Zero Books this month. Chris O'Leary, thanks for coming on to the Zero Squared podcast.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, so you describe your book, Rebel Rebel, as partly a potted cultural history of the 20th century, but it is primarily a book analyzing the music. You're writing about every David Bowie song from 1964 through 76. What is this book? Is it an encyclopedia? Is it a narrative? Is it a history?
I guess you could say it's all three. That's a good way to get out of that question. it began, I mean, because it started as a blog and I was writing it entry by entry, it was just sort of, it just kind of going along every day, not quite having any kind of overarching theme. And then when I went back to the blog entries to revise them into the book, I tried to see if there was any kind of through line that kind of connected all this stuff, or if it's, and I think there is. I mean, I think there is sort of a narrative about David Bowie, you know, the rise of David Bowie, you could say. It starts with him being a pretty obscure artist in 1964, and it ends with him as a number one hitmaker in America, starring in a movie, you know, on television with Cher, all that sort of thing. So, but it's also very much a song-by-song guide to his music, and you can jump around to whatever song you like at any point. It's not like it's a, you know, step-by-step narrative.
So what motivated you to start your blog, Pushing Ahead of the Dame? That's the name of the blog, right? I'm getting that right?
Yes, it is. Oh. Yes.
And what does that name mean, actually? Is that a title of a Bowie song that I'm unfamiliar with, or...?
I started the blog kind of on a whim, and the title reflects it being created on a whim. I took about 5 minutes to think about what I would call it, and okay. It's a pun. It's a lyric in a song called Queen Bitch, and it's the line is, she's known in the darkest clubs for pushing ahead of the dames, plural. And in the 80s, the British press snarkily called Bowie the Dame, singular. So with the conceit of going song by song chronologically, I'd be pushing ahead of Bowie, a.k.a. the Dame. It's kind of a silly pun, and some fans actually have been slightly offended by it, because the Dame is kind of a mocking nickname. And in retrospect, maybe I should have called it Bowie Songs, but, you know, that's the title.
Well, you come to Bowie as a fan. I mean, this is clearly a work of done for the love. I mean, you are a fan of David Bowie. I mean, you're not just knocking him here, right?
Oh, no. But what I think differentiates it is that I'm a fan, and when I was a teenager, I loved his music. But I was never consumed with him that much. And not in the way that, say, Bob Dylan did or The Clash did when I was a kid. I've always, you know, he's always kind of been at a slight distance from me, and I think that maybe helps in the writing to be a little more objective.
Do you credit him with that distance?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I make a claim that somewhere in Changes, the song Changes, is one of the few times you could kind of say Bowie is writing a song for a generational song in a way, even though it's a very singular song like a lot of his songs are. But I think, you know, Bowie, part of his mystique is that he is kind of one step away from you in any, at all times in a way. He's not somebody like I'm trying to think of like a Bob Seger who's like so charged into his audience and has this kind of reciprocity. I think people like that he is sort of maybe at a slight distance from them, at a remove from them, and that kind of makes him more appealing.
I'm 44, just to throw that out there, and I have friends who are in their 20s, and I was talking to one of them, he's actually a composer, about the Talking Heads. Who for me are kind of iconic. It's an iconic band. It's a huge band. And he was saying that, you know, in his generation, people have pretty much forgotten about the Talking Heads. They're not significant for people. At least that was his impression. He knew who they were. He was a fan of some of their songs, but he didn't think of them as on par with, like, say, Elvis Presley as being timeless or something. Where do you think David Bowie falls? Do you think Bowie is, are you going to turn around in, you know, 3 or 4 years and have some 20-year-old snot tell you they don't know who David Bowie is?
I think it wanes and waxes. There was a period, I think, in the early 2000s where even though he was still popular, he was still selling out stadiums and what have you. I don't think younger people, and I was in my late 20s by then, so I'm just kind of projecting on people who are younger than me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he was that part of their lives. Things like Heathen and Reality, the last records he put out in the 2000s, it's like you see like a Pitchfork review, you know, the best albums of the 2000s. Those things are never on those lists. They kind of don't exist in a way in the popular narrative of Bowie, which is like Ziggy Stardust and then Soul and then Let's Dance and then weird stuff in the 90s, and that's it. And so the stuff he does in that turn of the century, maybe he was not that, you know, maybe someone would have said that in 2003, for example. But I think with his comeback the last couple of years showed how much he is still considered kind of current by a lot of people. I mean, I get a lot of email and a lot of reaction from young people. I can say condescendingly, I'm 43.
People in their teens. So yeah, we're the same age.
People in their teens and their 20s who had never seen him live, who for most of their growing up, he didn't even put out albums. And he's still huge and fascinating. So I think his stuff maybe right now is pretty au courant, maybe more so than the Talking Heads, who I think will probably get rediscovered by a generation at some point.
So in your introduction to Rebel Rebel, you point out that pop music is acting.
Yes.
Yeah, and the consequence of this is that Bowie has turned out to be impervious to charges of inauthenticity. He's embraced these charges. Yeah. So would I be crazy to think that Bowie, as an artist, belongs on the side of people like Brecht and other avant-garde artists who want to establish this critical distance we were talking about earlier?
Yeah. I think there are times he would like you to believe that, but I think there's two halves of him. There's the sort of avant-garde side to him, the guy who, it's a running shtick that starts in the 70s, that he'll tell an interviewer every couple of years, you know what I really want to do is chuck it all in and become a painter and live in a garret somewhere and stop dealing with pop music. I'm so sick of this. And then he comes out and makes more albums. I think there's that side of him, but there's also the entertainer side of him, the side that loves Anthony Newley and the side that always wants to be a pop star and the side that really gets charged up by connecting with huge audiences. Right now for my blog, I'm reviewing the last concerts he ever did, the 2003-2004 tour. And if you just watch footage of him, he is incredibly engaged with the crowd and cracking jokes and doing pantomime things, and just it's like anti-Brechtian.
Right.
It's very much, it's like just, it's somebody just trying to entertain, gloriously. So I think that's kind of the fun of Bowie, is that he has this alienation, and his songs are about alienation. That's a common theme, but it's very rare that you will find a song that has like that will distance you, that you're just like, this song is unnerving. There are those, but they tend to come at periods where he wants to be out of the spotlight. For example, the late 70s Berlin quote-unquote albums.
I'm not that familiar with the early Bowie. I think of him as being a product of the 70s.
What? Yeah, nor was I when I started this. Yeah, I didn't know the 60s stuff very well.
Was the Bowie of 1964 or 66... the same? Is that the same Bowie that I'm familiar with? How did he start out?
Yeah, I mean, I think fundamentally he is. I mean, it's just somebody who is trying to perfect, just trying to get through the door in any way possible. So he starts out basically imitating the Rolling Stones and the Who, and that doesn't work out because he's not as good as them. And then he kind of takes a left turn, and he's working on with Tony Hatch, who is the great producer of Petula Clark Records, and he tries for this kind of big, grand, mid-60s pop, and that doesn't work either. And then he shifts gears, and suddenly he's doing, stranger stuff, more Anthony Newley-inspired, and also slightly more avant-garde stuff, things influenced by the Velvet Underground and Frank Zappa and the Fugs, a lot of which he never got released. But there's a kind of a core sensibility that's there from the beginning. That's there in Space Oddity. That's there in Young Americans and onward. Maybe one aspect of it is being somebody who is just a fan of things, of music, of books, of films. Someone who just wants to absorb everything and is just sort of sucking in all this information and all this stuff, and just trying to use it, process it, and use it almost immediately for his own ends. And I think that's kind of a constant from the beginning.
So when you say that he wasn't as good as the Stones, do you mean as a musician, or as a singer?
As a composer, yeah. As a composer, he's not quite there yet in 65. I mean, it's tough. He's writing good songs, but he's up against, Ticket to Ride and like a Rolling Stone. You can't, My Generation, he's not writing those songs. He has a very public apprenticeship. In all these flop singles he puts out on Parlophone and Pi Records, it's really fascinating. But he learns. That's the thing. Like each sort of failure kind of gives him a little more strength, and he finally breaks through with Space Oddity, in which he kind of is like mapped out like a battle campaign. He's like, this is going to be it, and he kind of is self-loathing about making this hit, but he knows he's doing it. He knows this is the one.
ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Detach from station and may God's love be with you.
It's very much a Bee Gees, you know, Zager and Evans kind of big, elaborate production. Of course, and pegged to a news event, even Bates. It's very much like, it's almost like a sell-by. It's got a sell-by date to it, which is the moon landing.
Right. Only, of course, it endures, but...
Yes, of course. Yeah, that's the thing, that he finally gets over the hurdle, and this is his first kind of real immortal song.
And that's the song where he's acting.
Yes, very much. Yes, it's very much a kind of a mime routine or in song. It's sort of a theater piece, and you know it starts out with him doing two sides of what was once a duet. He had a partner named John Hutchinson, and so you know he's doing both voices in the ground control of Major Tom. The beginning, Hutchinson was ground control. And so it starts with him doing that, and then it builds up, and he plays Major Tom, and then he's even doing, like, weird Greek chorus kind of things with, like, the, you know,
right.
The backing voices kind of coming in and commenting on the action.
Yeah, it's a little play.
Yes, there. Exactly.
And he liked it. I mean, you say it was kind of shamefaced about it. What is it about that kind of approach to music that people don't feel right about? Why is that little narrative so despicable?
I think it was the milieu he was in. He was in late 60s underground London, and by that point it was not really hip to have a hit single. Tony Visconti, his friend and his producer, really thought it was a bad idea. He's come out and said he's regretted it, but like at the time he was like, don't do this, it's like a Benny Hill song, you know, this is going to date you, and what you should be doing is these albums. Let's just keep doing these kind of underground albums with folk influences and hard rock, and that's the way forward. And don't do this silly, you know, New York mining disaster 1941 knockoff. It's going to really hurt you. And you know, that's part of it. It's there's a sort of suspicion of popularity among his crowd at that time.
But that was what he was. I mean, he was always going to.
But part of him is like, yeah, but I want it. I want a hit. I've always wanted a hit. And that kind of pulls him through.
Although, I mean, I just thought of Phil Oakes, you know, who wanted to be a big hit maker too, and it was a disaster for him to try to go that route, dressing up like Elvis Presley and all of that kind of thing.
And he's had a sort of Starman also. He's always had a slightly askance relationship with these songs because they are his huge songs that made him. But he also kind of regards them as, I think, curios, you know. And when he does them live, you know, he doesn't roll his eyes, but like you've seen him in interviews say, like, you know, ground control to Major Tom again, here we go. You know, this kind of like slight resentment of these songs, which, you know, I think he thinks, you know, are maybe kind of played out, and what's the point of doing them 50 years later? But even though he does them because the crowd wants to hear them.
And what do you think of them? What do you think of Space Odyssey? Space Oddity.
Oh, it's a brilliant song. I mean, it works. It shouldn't work in a way. It's really oddly constructed. It goes in and it's all over the place. But it's a beautiful song, and it really emotionally is very. Even though it's about a spaceman and it's sort of a strange lyrical concept, it's very emotionally resonant still. As I say in my book, it takes on a poignancy given to what happened to the American space program, which basically was shuttered in 1972, and we haven't gone further than the moon. We haven't been back to the moon since I was an infant.
Right.
And it's kind of like a sad, you know, a future that never happens, because we figured everybody in 1969 assumed we'd have a Mars colony probably by 2015.
Now. Sure. You know? Yeah.
We'd be on Jupiter by now.
Yeah. So. That'd be difficult to stay there.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. I love the song. And, but I want to ask, who is Anthony Newley? You've mentioned him, and I feel shamefaced.
Oh, yeah. Anthony Newley is he's a real key influence in Bowie's, kind of development. He was a British light entertainer, mainly a stage entertainer. He had some hits, but he was like a I'm trying to think of an example, like a Roddy McDowell who sang, like sort of a, you know, just a charismatic British guy who was in a lot of movies and a lot of stage reviews, but he had a quirkiness and a very self-conscious charm to him, very much aware that he was a performer, very much someone who didn't take himself seriously. And, you know, Bowie obviously took some of his phrasings and some of his, you know, he sounds like Newley in a few of his debut album songs. Kind of like a, you know, the more stagey affectations that some people will talk about, they'll describe it as Newley-esque, even though it's not quite. But
do you think that Bowie's ambiguous sexuality gives him the opportunity to be campy and yet still take himself a little more seriously?
Yeah, I mean, he obviously plays with that. You know, he knows that, you know, it's something that will get him headlines, and he does it very self-consciously when he, you know, says I'm gay in 1972. But he's playing with that in a way that it's slightly dangerous. You know, he could lose his audience substantially. But he has enough ambiguity that he's confident enough he's not going to be defined solely as a gay singer. But then he takes pains very quickly to say, you know, I'm not gay. And of course, this happens in the 80s. He publicly denies he ever, you know, was the biggest mistake, quote, he ever did, was identifying as a bisexual, which offended some people. But it's sort of just part of his kind of outsider affectations. It's the natural culmination of him just defining himself slightly outside of the mainstream. In every juncture, so like going one step further.
Do you cover in your book the duet he did with Bing Crosby?
No, that's not quite there yet. That's the next one. That's 77. Yes, almost made the cut.
Because for me, that's
marvelous. That's very much his light entertainer side. You know,
right.
You wouldn't see Alice Cooper duetting with Bing Crosby, but you know, you wouldn't see Johnny Rotten or something, but you know, they've
well,
really worked for,
yeah. Nowadays you might see anything, but yeah.
You know, it's
what I remember from that little bit is that there's before they start singing, I think they sing White Christmas.
Little Drummer Boy. It's a medley with a strange song that was created for the show, which nobody has ever sung again, called Peace on Earth. It's sort of a prefab Christmas song,
right?
That's mingled with Little Drummer Boy,
right? So, but he seemed to be taking great pains to paint himself as a family man in that bit.
Yes, yeah, which he was. I mean, he was a very devoted father, and yeah, it was just sort of it's just the way he could kind of, you know, play with the stuff. Like, I'm going to be quote normal here, you know, but even though I'm not quite normal, and you know that, and I know that. And other times he'll like try to emphasize his outsider credentials. It depends on the situation he finds himself in, I think.
Yeah, so that's very interesting just to watch them talk and the
yeah,
and
yeah.
It's not. I mean, they're both. Neither one of them are normal, right?
No, exactly. Bing Crosby is just as surreal as he is at that point. And he's very near the end of his life. He looks frail and kind of not quite there.
You the new butler?
Well, it's been a long time since I've been the new anything.
What's happened to Hudson?
I guess he's changing.
Yeah, he does that a lot, doesn't he? I'm David Bowie. I live down the road.
Oh.
Sir Percival lets me use his piano when he's not around. He's not around, is he?
I can honestly say I haven't seen him, but come on in.
Come in.
But come on in.
Are you related to Sir Percival?
Well, distantly, yeah.
Oh, you're not the poor relation from America, right?
Gee, news sure travels fast, doesn't it? I'm Bing.
Oh, I'm pleased to meet you. You're the one that sings, right?
Well, right or wrong, I sing either way.
Oh, well, I sing too.
Oh, good. What kind of singing?
Well, mostly the contemporary stuff. Do you like modern music?
Oh, I think it's marvelous. Some of it really fine. But tell me, you ever listen to any of the older fellas?
Oh, yeah, sure. I like John Lennon and the other one with Harry Nilsson.
Ooh, you go back that far, huh?
Oh, yeah, I'm not as young as I look.
None of us is these days.
In fact, I've got a six-year-old son, and he really gets excited around the Christmas holiday thing.
Do you go in for any of the traditional things in the boy household Christmas time?
Oh, yeah, most of them, really. Presents, tree, decorations, agent sliding down the chimney.
What?
I was just seeing if you're paying attention. Actually, our family do most of the things that other families do. We sing the same songs.
Do you?
I even have a go at White Christmas.
You too, huh?
And this one. This is my son's favourite. Do you know this one?
Oh, I do indeed. It's a lovely thing.
Let's talk about all the young dudes. Now, when I hear that song, you've reminded me in this conversation about his song Young Americans, right? Which I'd forgotten about while I was writing this question.
Young Americans, that's his Brechtian song, if there ever was one. Young Americans is like a Brechtian Bruce Springsteen song. It's very strange and cold, that song.
Okay, well, let's talk about Young Americans then, and maybe all the young dudes too, because when I hear all the young dudes, I think of Kim Wilde's Kids in America and how...
You said that. That's interesting.
How different... they're on the same page, but they're complete opposites, you know? All the young dudes is looking at youth culture and the what it is to be, you know, free and young and a little bit lost. In fact, very lost, where Kim Wilde is celebrating being swept up into a world that doesn't make any sense to you.
Well, first, keep in mind that it was written, he wrote it for Mata Hoople, a band he really loved. He was a fan of them, and they had hit hard times. Their albums were not selling very well, and they had a pretty disastrous tour, and they were thinking about breaking up. And Bowie was such a... This is a common thread in his life. He's such a fan of somebody that he's like, no, wait, I'll write you a song. You know? And so that was the start of it. And part of it was Bowie was always fascinated by bands. I think he always wanted to be in a band, but he didn't. He wanted to be the first among equals. You know, this kind of fantasy about, you know, I could be in the Beatles, but I could be John and Paul together. But I would still be in the band, you know. And it didn't work out. But... To him, he romanticized Mata Hoople. To him, they were like normal musicians, guys from middle of England. But to him, they were like a street gang, like a biker gang. They were dangerous. They lived on the edge. It's really kind of tough motorcycle, you know, hellions. And he kind of romanticized this camaraderie that they had, these five guys. And so All the Young Dudes takes power from Bowie, you know, projecting this sort of desire to be part of a gang, which was something he never really did. His songs are often about being alone or just trying to find connection from a very isolated perspective. All the Young Dudes is all, you know, the perspective is the common. It's the name of the gang, all the people's names, everyone's together. And that's the melancholy of it, is maybe the longing for something he never really had and maybe never really wanted. And the other part of it was that it kind of came out of his Ziggy Stardust 5 years stuff, and that he envisioned it as like this was the last generation. You know, if say there was a nuclear war in 1980, this would be the last teenagers, the last gang. And that kind of gives a sadness to it. You know, these are the last young people on the earth, possibly.
To me, All the Young Dudes has a political edge to it. The only sense of connection and camaraderie you can find is in a criminal gang of some kind or another. You know, it reminds me of like Rebel Without a Cause and that kind of thing. And there's an apocalyptic quality to it as well. And just to stick with my stupid metaphor about Kids in America.
No, yeah, but that's different. That's very much a Reagan era
right.
version.
It's like we can live through a nuclear war. The apocalypse will be fun. Let's go shopping. That's kind of the. But even there, in Kids in America, there is a sadness.
Young Americans is an interesting song in that it's kind of, and you can tell he maybe starts out trying to write a song like all young dudes for his soul album, for his soul Latin album.
Mm-hmm.
And he also was really taken with Bruce Springsteen at the end of 1973 and early 74. He loved Bruce Springsteen, was fascinated by him, and covered two of his songs. And so it was the attempt of maybe like, you know, I want to hit, and also it was very, you know, I want to hit in America. Good way to do that is have a song that says "Young Americans, all right." You know, Americans like being flattered and like singing along,
right.
You know, singing their own country's name. But very soon, the final lyric, is a much stranger thing. It's like there's a boy and a girl, and they're like puppets being moved around the stage, and then it kind of falls apart. The whole narrative, and it just becomes like this series of curses and rants about America by somebody who obviously is not an American. Someone, and I describe in the book, it kind of feels almost like a Maoist era cultural revolutionary Chinese take on, you know, American society of like, look at the young Americans, look at these foolish people wasting their lives, but what saves it though is that he has Luther Vandross and Ava Cherry singing this great hook, all the big high notes and this great driving feel to it, which means you sing along despite yourself. If you actually sit down and listen to the song, you're like, this is a strange song, but most people just love hearing the big Young Americans hook, and it has this great drive to it. So it works on both levels.
Speaking of the Maoism, there's Bowie's song Panic in Detroit.
Yeah.
And you write about that song, that by 1977, political violence was a means of self-expression, and that revolutionary cells had become performance artists.
Yeah, earlier, 73, yeah.
Yeah, okay, 73, yeah. This would fit right into Bowie's approach to music because, you know, he is, in a sense, a performance artist too, and mm-hmm. He could relate to political violence as a means of self-expression.
Yeah, he was fascinated by it. By the devolution of leftist activism into these kind of stunt terrorist groups like the Weather Underground and Bader Meinhof and the Red Brigades, the Patty Hearst SLA, which at some point were totally disconnected from any actual leftist movement. They weren't tied to any communist party or leftist party. They weren't trying to advance anything. They were just basically interested in blowing things up and getting headlines and recruiting people to blow up more things and to kidnap more people. It became like essentially a sort of a rock and roll touring thing. You have squabbling members, you have factions, you have cult of personality, you have financing problems, which you get by making shit deals with the mafia or something for money in exchange for robbing a bank. So but everyone's photogenic and they're good looking people and they're on magazine covers. So that sort of thing just totally entranced him. He thought it was fascinating. Definitely Panic in Detroit is talking about that, talking about Che Guevara becoming a pinup idol. Some of it came from Iggy Pop's recollections of the Detroit riots in 67, I believe it was.
Was Bowie just picking this up and putting it on display without comment, you know? So, I mean, he was fascinated by it.
I don't think it's a condemnation of it at all. I think it's just, you know, this is kind of funny and absurd, and take a look at this. And I'll set, you know, and then, but who cares? Because then I'll give it a killer guitar riff, and, you know, that's the main thing. But, you know, if you want to take time to listen to what I'm saying, you might get a kick out of it.
So Bowie wrote this song, Andy Warhol, and, you know, I didn't even remember that song, but
it wasn't a hit or anything. Yeah.
But it seems, I mean, they knew each other, or they met each other, Bowie and Warhol.
Yes. Yeah, after he wrote the song. He wrote the song when he just knew Warhol through magazine articles and books. So it's very much his idea of what Andy Warhol's life must be like.
Lou Reed knew Andy Warhol, owes his career to Andy Warhol, is nothing like Andy Warhol, or was nothing like Andy Warhol, really. I mean, totally different personality. Bowie, if Andy Warhol was a pop star, he might be David Bowie, right?
Yeah, Bowie saw in Warhol things he could use, strategies he could use quite well. One of the ideas being Ziggy Stardust, because the original idea for Ziggy Stardust was that Bowie wouldn't have to play him all the time. Maybe he could outsource it to another singer at some point when he got bored. Then someone else would be Ziggy Stardust, kind of like Doctor Who. There'd be a new Ziggy Stardust every couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
That soon went by the board because he became associated with the character, but that was one of his ideas. And he was creating a fake rock band in early 71, which some of the Ziggy Stardust songs begin as, with like a fake, the guy who actually didn't sing, and he would sing the songs for them. So that kind of stuff really, he was playing with the idea of kind of pop fabrication and, you know, rock is an assembly line production thing.
Bowie respected and admired Andy Warhol, but Andy Warhol hated the song.
He did. That's according to Bowie. That's the only evidence we have. Though somebody, I think one of Warhol's people in a book later said that Warhol, when Bowie left, said, like, can we sue him for using my name? Like, is he just be allowed to do that? Like, I don't think they liked each other that much. I think they were interested by each other, but I don't think they ever in Warhol's time on Earth ever had a conversation barring, you know, pleasantries or something. I don't think they were nothing like, even William Burroughs, Bowie had more of a tie to.
So what do you think the reason would be that Warhol would not like that song?
Warhol was a very shy person and someone who was very controlling of his image. And here was this unknown, because Bowie, no one knew who he was in 1971. He was this unknown weird dude who shows up and he's like, here's my song called Andy Warhol. Like, that might be disconcerting to anybody. You know, it'd be one thing if Mick Jagger came to him and said, yeah, I've written a song called Andy Warhol. You know, maybe he would find some, like, celebrity gratification from that. But instead, it was just this oddball guy, you know.
But that was was post-Space Oddity. I mean, Bowie
was
a star.
But Space Oddity was not really a hit in America.
Okay.
And so he was still, you know, until Ziggy Stardust, he was pretty much a relative unknown in much of the U.S.
But what about the attitude of the song itself? Were there digs at Andy Warhol in the song? Are there digs at Andy Warhol?
No, not really. No, it's like it's just sort of, you know, his idea of what Warhol's life must be like playing with paper dolls and sort of making art in a bored way. It's again, going back to mime, it's sort of a pantomime version of Andy Warhol, like watch Andy do this, watch Andy paint, watch Andy fall asleep watching his own movies. And it's very detached. It's like Bowie peering at Warhol through a telescope, and like, this is what I see. This is my idea of him.
And so, and that's what Andy Warhol did himself.
Yeah, and that's what Warhol did himself. So maybe he viewed Bowie rightly as a kind of a competitor in the same sphere.
What do you think of Andy Warhol? Do you like Andy Warhol's work?
I do like Andy Warhol. I like the early Warhol. At some point, especially once he's shot in 68, he kind of retreats behind the image of Andy Warhol. And I think his work becomes pretty derivative after that. But definitely the early 60s stuff is wonderful, I think. The movies I've tried, you know, I've seen them. I saw a lot of movies in college, but a lot of it is not my... Even I have a tolerance for a lot of avant-garde movies, but, you know, Sleep, for example.
No.
Yeah. I couldn't. I tried. I think I made it through 2 hours one time.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I was a very self-punishing...
So, you know, in you remember Robert Hughes? You know who he was, an art critic.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he did late in his life. He did some interviews with art collectors, and he was talking mm-hmm. to this really mega wealthy art collector, and who's collected a lot of Andy Warhol's work and a lot of other pop artists' work. And he asked him, "So, do you think Andy Warhol is an important artist?" And he says, "Yes." And he says, "You know what? I've talked to Andy Warhol. I knew Andy Warhol, and I've never met anyone with fewer ideas and less to say than Andy Warhol."
But I think, I think Bowie found that appealing. I think he found somebody, you know.
Well, clearly, so did Andy Warhol, yeah. Right? I mean, that was all.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that was part of what Andy did.
For the whole thing.
But Robert Hughes would say, yeah, that's what he did. But he didn't really. I mean, he liked to present that. You know, people might think, oh, this is a really interesting facade. But there's nothing there but the facade, is what Robert Hughes is saying. He actually really didn't have any ideas. That's not the case with David Bowie.
No, but he's overrunning with ideas. That's like he's the polar opposite. There's so much he's thinking about and trying to channel.
Andy, do you feel that the public has insulted your art?
No.
Why not?
I hadn't thought about it.
It doesn't bother you at all, then?
No.
Well, do you think that they've shown a lack of appreciation for what pop art means?
No.
Andy, do you think that pop art has sort of reached the point where it's becoming repetitious now?
Yes.
Do you think it should break away from being pop art?
No.
Are you just going to carry on?
Yes.
When I arrived here, I got to the airport, and the first thing that happened is that there were three or four press people, I think, behind me in the line, who were saying, have you seen David Bowie yet? And I said, yeah, you can't miss him. He's just over there. He's got a green raincoat on and bright red hair.
Yeah.
And so they turned to me and said, is that David Bowie? And I said, yeah, I think that's him. And they went off, and the poor guy got hassled for a bit.
C'est votre vie tous les jours, every day is your life.
It does end in 1976, even though the blog, I'm currently finishing the mid-2000s period. Just because if I did every single song in one book, it would have been the size of the Oxford English Dictionary condensed edition, I think. It would have been 1,500 pages. It would have been absurd. But I had to break it off somewhere. And I chose Station to Station, the album Station to Station, because that feels like a natural end point for him. The subsequent book will start with the Iggy Pop records and Low and Heroes, those albums.